We're not strangers to violence. If anything, we experienced our first forms of violence at home. 2005, 2006, that was a bad year. There was a lot of violence happening in our area, people dying over there. At 16, I was charged with murder, and she said, the problem of the heart is the heart of the problem. For the first time in a long time, I felt at peace. Thank the Lord never forsake me. You know, He didn't leave me hanging. If anything, I'll turn my back on the Lord. My name is Bethany Fawai. First 5-6 years of my life, I spent out in Glendawi, but then we relocated to Panama Road. Yeah, so kind of grew up all in Panama Road. Mona and I, we co-chair the 180 Turn Charitable Trust. We got our name from basically our life experiences and having gone through the jail system, having gone as far as the system had to offer, and having made a 180 degree turn in our lives and coming back this way, trying to wipe down all the kids going that way. So that's how we got our name. Our aim is basically to have access to all these kids that are getting caught up in the prison system from a young age. We want a chance to work with these kids before they fully commit to their lifestyle and throw their lives away, you know, when you're growing up in the household, the first two people in your life, you're going to idolize and be a role model of your parents. And if you experience some kind of traumatic experience or hurt from those two people, you know, constantly, there's going to come a point where those kids are going to find those emotional needs elsewhere. Gangs come along looking very attractive, bling, money, cars, bikes, woman, you know, very attractive marketing for the kids and for those that are hurt, most likely going to say yes, you know. So yeah, I think just addressing some of the unresolved stuff, I think goes a long way.
I guess from there, bro, like what drives you to do this sort of work, brother?
My own experiences being in prison at a very young age and having spent a lot of formative years of my life in the prison system. Yeah, it was a life sentence.
So how long have you been out for now?
4 years yesterday. I ended up doing 13 and a half years in total. You know, when you're doing your sentence and you're thinking about this one day that's going to come, if it does come, you know, if you get released, you'll be the happiest person alive. And for me, I was a nervous wreck. Yeah, I didn't know what was happening. You know, a lot of anxieties. And I was just standing there in the holding cell, waiting for my anklet. I should have been happier than what I was, but you'd think I was about to do my life sentence all over again. It's just, yeah. Yeah, I was a teenage father. I met Stella not long before I went in, bro, probably 6 months prior.
So you're still with her now?
Hey, I've been blessed with her. You know, she's amazing. And she supported me throughout my whole time, you know. But even more importantly, she was able to look after my son and love him and care for him, you know. We all fall short of the mark at some point, but she was pretty solid, bro. Yeah, she was solid for me. And I'm still with her today, yeah. So I went to Panama Road, but my earliest memories were back in Glendawi, the age of 5 or 6, we moved over to Panama Road. I think the government evicted a lot of, pretty much bowled over all the state houses in the area. Home life was all revolved around church. My father was the dominant parent in our house. And you know, it was pretty much his way or the highway. He was always right, even when he was wrong, you know. But definitely a hard worker. He was also a staunch and devout Christian. And his father was president of the Free Church of Tonga at one point. So I think they had a big influence on my father and all his brothers. I think naturally he groomed to me for that life and pathway as well with the church. I never really got to know Jesus, you know. It was more religious, people with religious spirits, and you know, we had no choice, we just went along. My father loved the church, and there were times we thought that he loved the church more than us. And that was just based on the amount of money he was giving to the church. You know, and there was a lot of families that were doing that, you know, giving a lot of money to the church. For some reason, they believed the more money they gave, the more blessings the Lord will show them. But it created a lot of financial stress in the household. Yeah, so I started building a resentment towards the church. Jesus already paid the price for all of us, you know. All we got to do is believe in him, you know. So why are we still paying? Why are we paying financially? You know, today I just see some of those conservative churches as a business. So I love my father, you know. Growing up, he was my hero. He was everything I wanted to be. Like any son and father relationship, you know. But as you get older and you start to become a little bit more conscious, knocking on 10, yeah, getting towards around about that age, I started to realize certain things. Yeah, you start to pick out hypocritical behavior. Started to rebel the authority in my life, basically my father. But I enjoyed early college. A lot of my childhood friends and a lot of mates from school, kind of, that was the natural transition from Panama, Otahu Intermediate, early college. I think I was already a prisoner before I was in prison, you know, and that kind of started around about my college years, 14. I naturally started to drift away from what my father wanted for me, hanging out with boys that I met through my schooling years in primary, intermediate, guys that I already knew well. They were on the streets, you know, doing what they were doing. Just people I knew, you know, from schooling years, they were already part of the local gangs. You know, violence, we're not strangers to violence, bro, you know. If anything, we experience our first forms of violence at home and in the church. We see that and we get into little scuffles along the way, you know, because of what we see at home, you know. You step out of line at home, you get beaten up, you know, or you're whacked around. And it's the same views going to school, and anyone steps out of line in your opinion, obviously it's going to be a fight. But yeah, serious violence started once I started hanging out with the boys. Yeah, yeah. Look, before I even kind of talk about any of that, I just want to be clear to all our viewers out there, you know, I'm not glorifying that life and what it represents in any way, but I will talk about it to help our people understand, you know, a look warranted violent actions, you know, with our rivals, you know, other little alphabet gangs from around the area, but just anyone who wanted it, really. So the boys that I hung out with and then later became part of, they were all pretty much similar ages to me, maybe one or two years older. But we were also hanging around with, you know, older gang as well. And in the areas, older gangs, older fellas, generation before us. Yeah. In our area, Panama. So Panama is basically just a road, and it's literally on the border of South and East. But we kind of gravitated to more South. And so we're in between Mount Wellington and Oahu. So in Panama and in the Oahu area, yeah, I think at the time we were starting to build a reputation for ourselves, based on, you know, the violence. Boys were dishing out, yeah. Yeah, so leading up to prison, I'd probably say 18 months out from when I actually got locked up. There was a lot of violence happening in our area, and also just in Auckland in general. 2005, 2006, there was a bad year. You know, I don't know what was in the water in Auckland at the time, but there was a lot of serious, senseless violence happening at the time. And for us, you know, we didn't really care about what was happening outside our area. But when our associates at the time were getting locked up for murder, going on for GBH, people dying over these acts of violence, you know, it kind of the general consensus in our camp was, you know, any rivals we come across, you know, they were going to get it. Yeah, so the state of mind that I was in at the time leading into that, it wasn't too good, you know. If anything, we had already predestined our futures and our minds, you know, based on the music we were listening to. It was real violent music. You know, a lot of Dayton Family, Nationwide Rip Riders. You know, when I go back and I listen to these to their music, it's pretty violent, you know, glorifying all forms of violence and acts of revenge on rivals. And that's what we were listening to it at the time. Everybody would know that music has a big influence on everybody, everywhere. You know, when they start talking about the subconscious mind and what it's downloading, you know, every day, and how the subconscious mind actually has a big part to play in the decisions we make. So at 16, I was charged with murder. I was charged with GBH and got pretty much locked up straight away. On that night, seemed like any other night. Heading out to West Auckland there was a party happening there. One of my childhood mates wasn't part of the gangs either. Come pick me up for him. We made a stop at a dance function out in Avondale College. But in that time, we were just consuming alcohol and smoking drugs. And my cousin who was with us spotted one of our rivals at the dance function. And this was someone I had an encounter with 2 weeks prior to the incident. And you know, in that state of mind I was in, you know, there was no other way. I had to do something about him, and it's a sad mindset to have, really. I had all the options in the world, but in that time I didn't exercise any of it. All I remember was I was heading over, and I was looking to identify, from based on my last memory of the rival, and pretty much Yeah, pretty much. Just going over there to bang on them. At no point from the walk there that all was I thinking about consequences, or I was thinking about hurting anyone. The only person I was thinking of hurting was our rival that was spotted there, and so it turned out that although he sustained injuries from that violent attack, but another young doggo as well, teenage doggo, lost his life based on my actions, bro. Everything kind of happened so fast, you know. But yeah, that's something I take full responsibility for. Even though I was drinking and smoking drugs, I just want to be clear that in no way, shape or form was that an excuse for anything I'd done, you know. That was all me. And whether I was sober or not, I think that incident would have still went down. And I got taken to the police station, Auckland Central. I was taken to the police station there, and first time in my life I was sitting in a prison cell. I knew I was going away for a long time. I wasn't even aware someone had died until I got charged with the murder. Yeah, so, you know, sadly, I was playing a victim card, you know, and though today I know full well, and I'm fully responsible for all my crimes, you know, and I don't blame anyone for that. You know, those were decisions I made, and something I fully accept and am remorseful for. But at the time, sadly, I was playing the victim card, bro. Yeah, I didn't know what to expect, but going into youth prison, Youth Justice North, I don't know what to expect, but in my mind, if I was going to come across any, you know, this is how I was thinking at the time. You know, in my mind, if I bump into any of our rivals, you know, it was just bang on sight. It was just a mentality I had at the time, and so there was a lot of anxiety as well, like, and obviously, you know, a little bit scary for me because I didn't know what to expect. Yeah, so a lot of the kids there at the time weren't strangers to the system. Like, a lot of them, some of them were foster and foster care homes, and I don't know, a lot of them were gangsters, you know, and still gangsters today. There were guys there that I'd known from the streets. They were already in there. There were guys that were from way down in the South Island, all over the place. Some of them I got to know and form good friendships with. Yeah, sentencing wasn't good for me. And I only can imagine it wasn't good for the victims either. But the only thing I had on my mind was, you know, wanting to get out of there. I didn't want to be there. I remember sitting in the holding cell. My lawyer was talking to me about, you know, when I get up there, just, you know, telling me how to present myself, stuff like that. And then I was asking him if media were going to be present. And he said they weren't going to be present. And then when I walk into the courtroom, media were present. And so already that kind of annoyed me about my lawyer. And I wasn't even thinking about what my victims were going through, or how they were feeling, or my own family. I ended up walking out of the courtroom poking fingers. You know, and it wasn't a good look for me, you know, because I knew deep down in my heart, I did feel remorseful for what I'd done. And so, yeah, I didn't get to process myself in my cell, you know, sentencing till later. No, unbeknownst to me, things were gonna get real worse, you know, before they even got better. I went into the Old Rock, Mount Eden, and it was only a transit unit, you know, 2 weeks there, and then I got sent off to Paremoremo, and pretty much started my leg up there. Things didn't really kind of settle down for me. I ended up getting charged with GBH within those 6 months. You know, and at the time I thought, you know, violence committed in the prison would stay in the prison. I didn't realize police can come and arrest you and take you back out to the courts and process you and, you know, add more time to your sentence. I don't know any of that stuff. But after my sentencing, like I said, I was playing victim because in my head, I felt like I shouldn't have been charged with murder. So, I was quite angry, playing a victim card, and then I was still getting caught up in a lot of violence in it. And so, yeah, caught a GBH charge, and then ended up getting charged for another murder. Yeah. Real delusional way. But I wasn't even thinking about release at that point, you know. That was the last thing on my mind. I was just thinking about getting through the day, you know. There's a lot of things going on in the prison system. I didn't think I was going to be sitting here today. You know, for like about 2 years, I was on this regime called directed segregation. So that's a regime where if you're playing up in general population in Maxi, you go into directed segregation, you know. And that was a tough one for me because what my day consisted of in that regime was, you know, free screws would always come open the door, and you know, they'd process me, and they'd walk me to the yard, and the yard was just a concrete box. Couldn't even, you could see the sun, but the sun will never hit your skin, you know. I was 45 minutes in there, and then they'll take me back up, 5 minutes cleaning myself, 5 minutes shower, 5 minutes phone call, and then lock me up. And that was my day for like about 2 years, or maybe 23 months, yeah. Yeah, so it was a tough time, and, you know, I ain't proud of that, but, you know, what that does to someone, you know, being on that regime. There was a few of us, we were all on that regime, and, you know, you had to be tough to survive that. And I've seen a lot of people try and tap out on that regime. I ended up getting convicted of another murder and got sentenced to another 17 years. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, how the hell did I end up in this position, you know? One thing going to court for your own stuff, and it's another thing being stuck in that situation, you know, because there wasn't much I could do. You know, I wasn't going anywhere for another 11 years, you know, and then, you know, I couldn't snitch, otherwise I spent a life sentence running. That wasn't an option for me. You know, just wasn't an option at the time. So I couldn't put up no defense on that, you know, without incriminating anyone. So I just shut my mouth. And it was tough. And the only option I had was riding through that whole motion and banking on an appeal, because I wasn't going to defend myself in court. I couldn't. By God's grace, truth prevailed. But I think that whole situation alone was probably responsible for my recovery. My recovery started there, you know, before I even got to treatment. So I ended up spending my first 5 years at Porimorimo. And then after that, I just started getting moved around. As they say, bro, once you hit rock bottom, there's nowhere else to go but up. You know, and so, yeah, I knew then that that's not what I wanted, you know. I kind of knew prior to that, you know, with my first charge. But, you know, I wasn't able to just get over myself, you know, and accept it. For a lot of lifers, you know, you got to do a lot of rehab before you get up, you know, and there's just no question about that. And I've done the most intensive rehabilitation course for drugs and alcohol and also for violent offending. So all up, that's 18 months of programs daily. When I got to treatment, I remember getting there with a superficial attitude, you know. I didn't really want to apply myself to this course, but I'll do it because it's what I need to get up. And it's pretty much what a lot of jailbirds were doing, you know. Yeah, something strange happened. Very like, there was a lot of things happening at the time. But there was a lady who come through and done voluntary ministry there. And she, you know, she came through voluntarily. And I never really went to church at that point. I couldn't be, you know, spiritually, I couldn't probably be more further than from the Lord at that point. And then I went to church service and, you know, shared scripture and that. I was just sitting listening. She opened up the floor. And I remember asking a question, something like, you know, if this Lord that you're talking about is real, you know, why is it that I couldn't be more further away from him at this point of my life, you know? And she said, he hasn't moved one bit. And then I was like, thinking about it. And then before I could speak, she said to me, I'm going to share something with you, young man. And something I've never forgotten. And she said, the problem of the heart is the heart of the problem, you know? And that didn't sink in at the time. But that definitely was something I kept reflecting upon over the next year or so. And I think really, really gave me the right attitude to work hard on myself during treatment time. You know, to kind of address a lot of the issues, but not only that, just helping myself understand how a kid goes from how, the way I was brought up in my family home to a position I found myself in prison at 18. You know, it doesn't make sense for a lot of people. People are wondering why, but you know, for a lot of the time I was wondering how and why, you know. And so, you know, that was on my mind for ages, you know, and just so happens at the time of treatment, we were getting into the phase where we had to revisit the time frame of leading up to your crime, the crime itself and the aftermath. You know, for as long as I could remember, I had a lot of shame, you know, like there's healthy sides to having shame, you know, but there's toxic sides to having shame. And I learned that toxic shame is the belief that, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, every time at home, when, like, you know, I'd, doing things my father wanted me to do, and I just wasn't performing to his standard, you know, he'd come down hard on me, you know. And well, it wasn't so much the smacks or hurtings or whatever, but it was more the messages I was receiving, you know, like telling me all the put downs and the name callings. You know, you hear that stuff enough times, you're gonna believe it. You know, and that's what happened to me, you know. I started to believe a lot of those messages I was getting from the old man, you know, and like there was a lot of other incidents happening in the household at the time as well that I never got a chance to unpack, you know. A lot of traumatic events for us as kids. You know, there was a lot of drinking in my house. There was a lot of violence in my house as well. My old lady assaulted the old lady, and she was unconscious, and cops came, locked them up, processed them, whatever. When he finally got out, you know, I had to go stay with him, you know, and that was the last thing I wanted. I resented him hard at the time, and there was some other stuff as well, but I never got a chance to unpack all that stuff, you know, and deal with that stuff. My parents, you know, they were almost shadowy figures in my household, you know, like they were there, but they weren't really there. You know, my old man, like, never really conversating with him or anything like that. It was just dad in the house, you know. And then, so I learned all about the shame and that being a form of abandonment, all that kind of stuff. You know, as a kid in the first 7 years of your life, you don't process that stuff or sort that stuff out. It manifests and comes out in your teenage years. See, I didn't know anger was a good emotion, you know. Anger was a good emotion, and it was only determined by how you reacted to that emotion that made it good or bad. You know, in my household growing up, you know, for us kids, we didn't have a safe space to be angry, to know how to be angry in a safe way or healthy way. Anytime we've seen our role models angry, someone was getting in hiding, you know? Or there will be a lot of yelling and arguments. I never seen anyone to this day role model how to be angry in a healthy way. Now, for us, because we weren't allowed to be angry, like, it sounds stupid, but in my house, I wasn't allowed to show any forms of anger. You know, I'd get beaten up. That's just the way it was. But then you can see how going out there on the streets, mixed with alcohol and drugs, and then finally being angry, is going to come out nasty, you know? Our emotional health or our emotions are the biggest drivers in what we do. When I was going through a tough time, I wasn't asking for help. I didn't know how to ask for help, you know? I didn't know who to ask for help. And so I didn't ask for help. I didn't know how to do that, you know? I wasn't even talking. You know, like they say, if you talk about it, you know, you feel a lot better. I didn't learn that stuff till later. So yeah, I was granted parole, and was paroled out back to my homestead, my family home. And, you know, it was strange and good at the same time. Yeah. At that point, you know, I was no longer the person that I went into prison. And I was completely different. My way of thinking, just my views on life. But you know, there was one more thing that I needed to do. You know, it was constantly giving me a lot of grief and anxiety. And I knew I had to sit down and have a talk with my dad, you know. I knew I had to have that talk with him. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how I was going to start. But for a few weeks, I was like, constantly, eating at me. And so I finally summed up the courage and to call a meeting with my family, my dad and my mom and my siblings. And it took me a while to start, but once I started, I couldn't stop, And everything was just coming out. I was just talking about my childhood and how angry I was at my dad for it. And I just pretty much was coming from the start all the way. It was a real emotional time for me. I remember I was crying. And it was an emotional time for my siblings as well, having to revisit some of the things from childhood we never got a chance to talk about. And, but when I finished, I finished having my say, and my father said to me, what happened in the past, just leave it in the past, and that he loves me. For the first time, in a long time, I felt at peace, I felt at peace, and I believe that completed a big part of my healing, that I never really got a chance to kind of look into, I was able to forgive my father, but more importantly, I was able to forgive myself, bro. But, there's still another piece of my healing and forgiveness that I haven't been able to revisit or visit with my victims' families, And it's something I've got to live with for the rest of my life. But it's something you've got to carry and live with forever. I guess it's probably one of the big reasons why getting into the youth work and what we're doing with 180, is I think it's a great way to honor them as well. Who knows what the future holds? I spent a lot of time living in the past. Spent a lot of time wondering about the future. I think the best thing for us is trying to stay present every step of the way. Because you know as well as I do, bro, Jesus is coming, bro. And I'm just trying to make the most of every day. But obviously, we got plans for the future. And God willing, that'll play out for us. But, I got out of prison. Found it hard to get a job because of my criminal history. So I had to go the long way and go through a course at OCA. And was able to get a job there by someone that offered us work experience. Just ran ever since. Been in the building industry for the last 3 years, doing my building apprenticeship. And, just all the people that's helped me along the way, you know who you are. And I'll thank you heaps for that. I put my tools down just recently. As much as I was enjoying building and what that offered me, that wasn't my calling, bro. I'd rather be in the side where we're renovating and rebuilding people's souls. The future of our kids. 180 Turn has big plans. In the future, and watch the space. We're gonna blow up, bro. And that's all the Lord's doing. And all credit to the Lord, and glory to the Lord. Yeah, you're right. A lot of people don't know me as Bethany. They knew me as Scam, but that was a different life, and that wasn't me. Just remembering that that saying that the lady who came in with her ministry into the prison said to me, you know, the problem of the heart is the heart of the problem, bro. And I think that's only until you start looking into that stuff, you're able to find some healing. But don't give up the good fight, and talking about it, you know, as much as it was once upon a time frowned upon by men in our families, you know, because of the masculinity and the old and Pacific cultures, I think talking about it is the best thing you can do. I think the Lord never forsake me, bro. You know, He doesn't leave me hanging. If anything, I turn my back on the Lord, you know. But I only really got a real chance to know Him in the last 10 years, you know. Know about His love. And yeah, so during that time, I was going through my treatment. I started writing a poem, and took me about 2 years to complete. I took a leap of faith, because prison ain't my destiny. I studied my reflection as I questioned my identity. Will I have the courage confronting what's inside? Or will I isolate in silence because it's easier to hide? I can't escape the judgment, so I'm constantly rejected. But I can't give up on freedom if my family's still neglected. If my prison ain't in jail, then freedom ain't release. The walls of my emotions incarcerate my peace. I learnt about my triggers, a childhood full of shame, searching for significance because I never felt the same. I cannot blame a father for my current status quo, because his father couldn't teach him what his father didn't know. Today I am forgiven, a choice I chose to make. I refuse to keep on living defined by my mistakes. I'm grateful and I'm confident, since I swore my oath to be a better person and contribute to growth. Adversity builds character, but for me it's just begun. I'm doing this for freedom and the future of my son.
I understand that you're working with young people to make sure they don't go into the same things that you do.
There's a strong desire of mine and my partner Mona here.
Yeah, that's outstanding. Yeah. I'm very pleased to see you. I always wondered what had happened to you when you went off to jail that time. It's a very long time ago. Since then I've changed my job, and the better news is so have you. So I think you're going to be a fantastic mentor. You are not just talking the talk, you're walking the walk. So I am very pleased to see you at the back of my court. You're always welcome here.
Thank you.
So well done, young Batani. You're still young in my eyes.